Hey, Caleb Henry here for Husker Max today. We had a bit of a technology issue right off the bat, but Nick Hanley and I were able to dive into a full episode, including the ever-changing landscape of collegiate athletics, baseball, ahead of a big weekend down in Frisco. And we begin with basketball, Husker men and women, and their bracketology as well. Let's dive into that.
So, yes, we are going to get to a lot, and I'm sure, as I could not hear Caleb, he probably gave you a little bit of the rundown. A lot of the stuff that we not only didn't get a chance to touch on Monday, but more than anything, as we are now in the final day, or I should say the final 2 days of February. I mean, essentially, it's March right now. So a lot of the hoops that we're getting into has significance. Caleb, as I was saying, I know we didn't have a chance to talk much about it going into Monday, because there was a huge game that night at Pinnacle Bank Arena, and knowing that very unfortunate loss that Nebraska hoops had to Penn State, what a great opportunity to bounce back. And if you would have told me that Nebraska was going to keep Michigan in the mud in the 40s, I would have said, oh my gosh, you're going to win. This is going to be one of those beautiful gems at Pinnacle Bank Arena where Nebraska just locks down and maybe they score 60 points. But if they hold Michigan to 40-something points, it's game on. This is exactly where Nebraska wants to be. Unfortunately, and this is a bit of a concern for me, is this offense, which I know is not overly gifted, and a team that you can expect to be in the 80s every evening they go out there. There are limitations, but other than that Washington game, where I think that was the last time I remember them playing 40 minutes of actual solid offense. We remember how Washington was scorching hot in the first half and Nebraska was holding steady there. Mm-hmm. Since then, they've had some decent halves in spurts offensively, but they have not had that 40-minute look like they did against Washington. And unfortunately here now, the last couple of games, especially Michigan, which is a good team, obviously, but Penn State, that's been some woeful shooting. And I still believe this. I've said this for many, many years, is that if you are going to be an NCAA tournament team, you start to take on the look of that team right around this time, mid to late February. And if that's the case, boy, I'm worried about this offense.
Yeah, I mean, and the offense had been concerning even before that, right? You know, if you had – there were stretches where you didn't have Bryce Williams showing up. That hasn't been the case lately. He's scoring over 20 a game. You just didn't have anything from anyone else. And the concern becomes offensively what Michigan went to in the second half, what Dusty Mace talked about that they went to in the second half, where they just said – if there's ever a ball screen, and Nebraska loves its ball screens, that they were just going to hedge and double and just say, if anyone else wants to try to make something, go right ahead. We'll live with it. And ultimately, nobody really did. I know Sam Hoiberg hit 2 threes. That was great, but nobody else effectively did anything. Hoiberg was your second leading scorer in that game because of 2 shots, and that's all it took. Bryce only made 2 shots in the second half, only shot 4 free throws in the entire game. So there's a lot to look at offensively that needs to get fixed. Your number one shooter goes, what was it, 0 for 4 from deep. Bearkay has his return, and he goes 0 for 10 from the field. Somebody's got to do something, and that doesn't even count Braxton Mia and Andrew Morgan. You've got to get some. One of those guys has got to get to 6 to 8 points. That's not asking the world, right? No. Like, that's not saying you got to go get 15 to 20. I want 6 to 8 from you guys in there. And if combined you can get to 10, wonderful. Defensively, I don't have concerns. I know there are times that teams are just going to go nuclear from deep. That's just the way the defense is organized. But you're seeing some good defense be played, especially in the second half of these games. Can you get any offense to match it? And I don't know, but I hope with Minnesota, an Ohio State team you've seen once before already, and a home game with Iowa, who you've also seen once already, can get the offense a little bit back on track heading to Indianapolis.
Let me ask you this question, because it sounds kind of bizarre, given the fact that we were – really concerned that Buchtangel was out for the little stretch that he was, given where he was offensively before the ankle injury. The disjointed offense against Michigan, other than the obvious that Michigan is a very good team, The disjointed offense, though, I do wonder when you've all of a sudden forged a plan to play without a guy for, again, a short period of time, where you also have a guy like Bearcay, who was starting to have an offensive impact a lot more consistently, that you then remove him from the equation, then you bring him back into the equation. And if that could have led to the offense just really being out of sorts, and that's not say, hey, it's Bearcay's fault that he's back, and now all of a sudden, well, you got to sit him back on the bench. But I do wonder if there was an adjustment period and that was just the wrong team, like a Michigan team. Again, I'm not trying to make excuses for Nebraska, but if that was the wrong team to have him back in the lineup and just try to figure your offense out again after, I think Nebraska, for at least as much as they could, as much as I think this team can, was figuring some pieces out without him. I really like the way Braxton Mia it really asserted himself offensively in the absence as well. I think that, and he got the start, but there's part of me that wonders if that was just the wrong matchup to have Bearcay back and saying, okay, this is what we got to go back to doing again. I don't know. It's just a crazy theory. I'm curious what you think on that.
No, it's something good to bring up because we didn't delve too much into that on After Nebraska Ball, and maybe Jack and I will get into it with our Nebraska Ball brunch show tomorrow, which you can hear right here on the Husker Max YouTube page at 11 a.m. Also over on the I-80 Club YouTube. I know with Bearcay, he had just had his best offensive game. Before getting hurt, and he gets hurt late in that game. And then, yeah, you've gone through and tried to figure out who was going to do what in his absence. And really that became the combination of Braxton Mia and Andrew Morgan at the five spot, and then sliding guys all over with who's going to play the four. And so it became a kind of mix and match. I think when you look at the 10 shots that Bearcay took, and I'm talking specifically just the offensive end right now, I could probably see three or four that were really forced. There were also a couple of shots that I thought were really good that I went, I like him backing someone down on the baseline here and taking that kind of short corner turnaround. And he's made a number of those. He there's something funky going on with his shot. He like double cocked it at one point, and there wasn't really a reason to at the end of the first half. I thought he had a wonderful look at the end of the game. Like when you talk about throwing the ball the length of the court and it ending up in one guy's hands who can hit threes, it didn't end up in Braxton Mia or Andrew Morgan's hands. And I know that's not who you're putting out on the floor in that situation,
right?
But for it to fall to him and him to have an open look, He leaned back a little bit, and that's why it was short. Like you can get into all of the mechanics on the shot mechanics, but that was a good shot. So he took 10 shots, but there were also a lot of guys that were forcing stuff, and you shot 25% for the game. So I don't think offensively it was necessarily Bearcay causing some things to be disjointed. What I think Bearcay's contribution was, where I think it was biggest and most necessary, was on the defensive end and rebounding. Mm-hmm. You didn't get destroyed on the rebounds.
No, they didn't. Not
because
at all.
Because you were able to have a combination out there at times of Bearcay and Braxton or Bearcay and Andrew, and sometimes Bearcay at the five, and then you're figuring out who's guarding one of the 7-footers for Michigan. But him coming back helped that out in a way that you missed over the previous couple of games, because you needed him defensively. He ended up with, did he get two blocks? Yeah, he had two block shots. One of them just destroyed a guy right at the rim. Him defensively was a really big help for this team. And he ends up with 4 rebounds. But one of the things I talked with Jack about, because Juwan Gary had 3 rebounds over the previous 2 or 3 games. And I said the reason for that is he has to go be the guy getting a body on a big man.
Yep.
And instead of Bearcay, which frees Juwan to go kind of be athletic. You're 6'6". You're not going to go just jump somebody straight up. But if you can get lateral and just get going and be athletic, that's what Juwan Gary does. And what happens is Juwan ends up with 6 rebounds this game. Those are the types of things that there's little differences that I think overall – it was a positive to have Bearcay back in the game because of what he brought defensively and rebounding. But man, if something offensively, if he hits one shot,
Yeah, exactly.
Not even just that one at the end, but if he hits one shot leading into that, like, it's a different last minute the way it all plays out.
Yeah, and that's why I bring up the offense looking disjointed. And I don't want to make it come across as I'm saying, boy, Fred should have waited another game to bring Berkey back. No, absolutely. And I think you bring up a lot of good points on what he brought to the table, because the amount of misses in that game, Nebraska could have got completely run off the boards, and they were very competitive in that category. So there were the 12 offensive rebounds, which that was a problem, but still, that, I mean, both teams just building absolute houses with the bricks. And so it was great to see Berkey having that. And I think it's a great point. It's a very astute point on Juwan Gary being able to size up with somebody a little bit more within his range, that he's going to be effective on the glass. I think about this. If you could have had, say, that Penn State game where Berkey's back, I think there's more offensive involvement with him, or I think he's more effective offensively. Mm-hmm. I think it was a bad luck of the draw, because what are you going to do if you're Fred Hoiberg? If he's ready to play, you're going to play him. It's not like you're like, well, this isn't the team we want to do that. It was hard for me to get past the fact that if they're playing anybody but Michigan, that this would have been a little bit more, I think, of a, even with some clunkiness offensively, that you could survive with that. And here's the other part. When you're shooting 20%, and this goes back to something you bring up, Nebraska, we know, will have certain limitations offensively compared to certain teams that they're going to play in the Big Ten. And that is just a fact. That's their identity. They can defend at a high level, and that's what they're going to make their hay on. But if you could just shoot in the low 30s, you win that game. So please tell me, can they shoot in the low 30s? Because then they could beat Michigan.
They win by 10.
I know. It's probably a blowout. Although I'm sure Dusty May is saying the same thing, that if we could shoot in the upper 30s, we would have won that game by about 15. So yeah.
Because you look at it, and because it didn't, it was only a free throw contest for like two trips.
Yeah.
And which was amazing at the end, because you had Michigan made their two, Bryce made his two, and then it was a front end miss for Michigan. And then you had the Connor Assijan shot that didn't go, and then two more free throws for Michigan. That was it. Mm-hmm. As opposed to sometimes where you're like, this was 16 free throws in the last minute and a half. Yeah. You didn't get that. So you end up with Michigan going 8-for-13, Nebraska going 8-for-12. It was a wash when you look at the potential of where you get into the Knights of Columbus free throw, or the Elks free throw, whichever one of those fraternities it is. Shout out to that. That was always fun growing up, going to Ord to take on whatever our region or district was. But for Nebraska now, you've got three games left. A lot of the bracketology I've seen still says get to 19 and you're in. 19 in the regular season before you get to Indianapolis. So that's Minnesota this Saturday. That is Ohio State this next week at Ohio State. And then closing out home with Iowa the next Sunday. So coming around in like 10 days. According to ESPN, Joe Lunardi, this as of 2 days ago. So maybe some teams have shifted around. Nebraska, one of the last four in, which would send them to Dayton to play Oklahoma.
How about that?
That would be interesting on that 11 line for the Big Red. I'm also one of the people saying, in the hypothetical scenario, you absolutely count that as your first tournament win.
Yes, I'm 100%. It's the NCAA tournament.
If it counts for Indiana and everyone else, it counts for Nebraska. I don't care what Creighton people would say about Nebraska's first tournament win coming in Dayton. You would still get it. And also the teams in those first four, there's always one of them that makes a run to the Sweet 16 or the Elite Eight.
Yep.
So, like, it's not the worst thing in the world to get in there and not be matched up with a five seed or something like that. On the women's side, Nick, it was a really bad third quarter against Washington on Sunday. Alexis Markowski goes out a couple minutes in, and it was a really tight game up to that point. Kind of tweaks something in her back and is slow to get off the floor, goes immediately out the tunnel. She does come back a couple minutes later, but the run had started for the Huskies, who closed the third quarter on a 15-0 run. And it was just all kind of over from there. Both teams score over 20 in the fourth quarter, but the deficit's too big for the Huskers on senior day. Alexis Markowski does grab another double-double. I believe she's at 51 for her career, which is insane. There's going to be plenty of time to talk about what her legacy is with this with this basketball program, because she has been a stalwart for the last 4 years, and it's going to be weird to watch a team next year not have Markowski coming out with the starting lineup.
Yeah.
But there's one game left in the regular season that is on Sunday against Northwestern, who just had to forfeit their two games from their LA trip because they didn't want to travel to Los Angeles because there were wildfires across the city and the region that caused cancellations in the NBA, in all of, like, in every sport that was down there. There were cancellations or postponements, but the Big Ten says Northwestern needs to forfeit those games. For Nebraska on the bubble, that's still where they're sitting as one of the last four byes, and this was as of 2 days ago. So this is including that weekend game. So Nebraska sitting not headed to those first four locations, but actually right now on the 10 line would be taking on Oklahoma State in Baton Rouge, according to the women's bracketology on ESPN.
This is, at least from the men's standpoint, although they're running out of some runway to get to that number 19, which I'm with you. I think if they're there in the regular season, that's where they need to be. The women, they've got one left. And the good news is it's one of the worst teams in the Big Ten, in Northwestern. Mm-hmm. So, okay, well, then how do you approach that from what we do? I guarantee you, at least hope the team is not looking at it this way. But there is nothing good that comes out of this win other than having to win, and then you stay the course. Because the way that I look at Nebraska right now, they win this game, and then you win one in the Big Ten tournament, I think you're locked in. Mm-hmm. I truly feel you're locked in. You lose this game, we've got problems. Because
you're sweating it out.
Absolutely, because these are those types of games. This is why that Penn State loss for the Nebraska men, we talked about Northwestern and that Penn State stretch, that you weren't going to gain anything. It wasn't like all of a sudden Nebraska was going to start shooting up to an 8 or 7 seed. But what you were going to, what could impact you, is if you lost one or both of those games, boy, it shoots you right down. Because that there's no quality impact that is going to come with a victory like that. It's only going to hurt you. So that's what Nebraska is up against with Northwestern. And the reason I say that, you bring up the Alexis Markowski where she gets banged up. We already know what this team has dealt with when it comes to injuries with Potts and Widener. And all of a sudden,
and Prince right now.
Yeah, exactly. Prince. I mean, that's another good one too. I know it sounds like she should be good to go, but let's hope that is progressing to that. Whenever we see her at full capacity, I still don't think she's going to be 100%. So then you're looking at, I mean, your catalyst, the heartbeat of your team in Alexis Markowski. Not sure how she's feeling right now, but if there's just, I've always felt this way for the Amy Williams squad this year, and kudos to Amy Williams and her coaching staff, because they have squeezed everything out of this team despite those types of injuries. You get to a certain point where a team has horrific injury luck, and Nebraska is starting to teeter close to that, where you just get to a point where you have too many of them, and even the teams like Northwestern can sneak up and get you because you are just so badly beaten up. The health of this team, more than anything, concerns me. I still think with what they have and pieced together, they should be able to go out to Evanston and beat Northwestern. They do that, you're feeling pretty good. But I still think you got to get that one win in the Big Ten tournament to where you say, all right, we're good, we're in. Now let's just see where we fall from, into the seeding line. Let's see what that looks like. So don't overlook, and I'm not saying you are, but for fans, don't overlook it, given the health status of this team, into a team like Northwestern that knows, hey, this is it for us. So it's going to be essentially their national championship type game. You're going to throw everything at a team that is somewhat wounded right now. So those ones are always a little uncomfortable to experience, in my opinion.
In Nebraska right now, sitting on the 11 line for the Big Ten tournament,
yep,
which would have them playing on the first day next week, which is a Tuesday.
Yes. Good and bad on that, Caleb, because you'd love to avoid that first day, but the first day, in my opinion, especially for a team like Nebraska, gives you your best shot at getting a win too.
Yeah, if it comes down to just go get a win.
Yeah.
Win on Sunday and it just the chips fall and you're playing on that first day. Yeah, go blow somebody out right away and stack that up. We'll transition from there because there will be a lot more to talk about with basketball over the next couple of weeks. Baseball, though, continues to play in the South all over the place. Just going through saying, I've been to this state, I've been to that state, mm-hmm. now this one. Frisco is what they have coming up. First, though, Nick, let's look back to last weekend down in Louisiana because things started out looking really good on Friday with that 6-1 win. And then the Bats apparently hopped on a plane and came back to Lincoln because you get a 4-1 loss and a 10-2 loss. And it just kind of – and you had one of the Raging Cajun pitchers, I think, in that last game threw a complete game.
Yeah.
So, like, Nebraska was kind of Johnny Holstaff and Louisiana was cruising with their pitching. What were you able to see up close and personal with the Huskers Radio Network?
From the positive standpoint, yeah, you're right on Friday. But even on Saturday – two guys in particular that I thought it was very encouraging to see, not surprising, but it was encouraging because you just never know. It's a new season. It's early in the season, but Mace McConaughey's bounce back was fantastic. Gives you six innings of quality start on Friday. It's what you want to see out of him. I thought his, just a lot of the little things and what he does, fastball was popping, but he was keeping that low. He was not giving Louisiana anything to really tee off on at all. I thought he did a good job of mixing his slider and curve, just being in command the way that we were used to, especially at the end of last season of seeing Mason and why he got dubbed the Friday starter. And then Ty Horn, I thought, had another good bounce back. Look, they lost that first game on the Saturday doubleheader, but it wasn't Ty Horn's effort. It wasn't because Ty Horn was digging them in such a hole that they couldn't get out of. I thought Ty was – six innings again, just like Mason, gave you a quality start, gave you the type of performance that you want to see from your Saturday guy. So those two things, I think, were very, very positive. Caden Brumball was outstanding in that first game at the plate, and then we get into Saturday, and you're right. The Bats were just zapped, and it wasn't necessarily because we're now looking at a team that is averaging almost 11 strikeouts per game.
Mm.
And initially, yeah, you look at that and you're like, gosh, that's not good. Well, college baseball strikeouts are up. The thing that was, I'm sure, the most frustrating for Will Bolt and watching it from where we were is there were times that it seemed like hitters were being fooled to the point that they had no clue in the box because you had several strikeouts throughout that doubleheader on Saturday that were called strike threes. We're not the competitive protecting the zone, the shorten up the swing, trying to drive it up the middle type approach, which this team, I think, has really embodied and embraced. It just did not show up in a time that it really needed to. So collectively, too, it wasn't like there was just one guy that seemed to be fooled more than the other. I mean, it was a collective thing on Saturday where, and these guys are talking, too. They're communicating in between at bats. So it's not a lack of communication. I don't know what the magic button is there, but it was just that lack of aggressiveness early in counts, but then also the inability to protect when they were down in the counts. And that was a running theme for this offense. There was one guy, though, and I've been talking to Ben this week. I won't be on the trip this week, and it'll be David and Ben.
Okay.
I was talking to Ben about this earlier today, that there, I'm curious to see, because out of all of that, and if you're Will Bolt, and we know how competitive Will is, you're looking for someone just to step up. And if that person takes advantage of that opportunity, he might get another one too. Mm-hmm. Freshman Devin Nunez ends the first game of that doubleheader with a ground rule double, and then he gets the start at DH in game number three, where you could tell Will's like, hey, this was one guy who at least gave us a spark there at the end, even when the game was already over. What does he do? Well, he hits a home run in game number three too. And he had some good at bats. There was one where he was fooled. It was right before the home run. He comes up and he makes the adjustment. And see, that was the other thing for a freshman to say, okay, this is what I got fooled on the previous at bat. Now I know what I'm looking for. I'm going to make that adjustment. And he made it extremely positively.
Mm-hmm.
Your veteran hitters, you know, guys like Gabe Swanson, there are guys that are just fighting it. And I think there's probably some overthinking that are going into it because they know the expectations on those guys that I think they just need to somehow figure out a way to slow it down a little bit. But when you see a freshman doing something like that, and taking advantage of those opportunities, I wouldn't be shocked if you see him in the lineup either tomorrow night and, dare I say, in that marquee matchup against LSU too, because at this point, if your offense is a little bit sporadic, well, you got to give the guys that are taking advantage of those opportunities, even if they are a freshman. And Devin Nunez put a couple of good swings on it.
I like that when you have a freshman, because it can go both ways. Sometimes the freshman can be overwhelmed, or they can be so oblivious at times. And you see it in any sport where it's just, they're just going to go out and have fun because they're a freshman. There really aren't expectations a lot of time.
Right.
Unless you're, say, Dylan Raiola and you're the quarterback for the football team. There are times that you put out a freshman at wide receiver, you know, and it's just like, hey, run a go route. Just run really fast.
Yeah.
He's going to throw it up.
Just take out the guesswork.
Yeah. So I like that it was you don't want to get fooled, but I like that you saw him get fooled, get beat, and say, what do I need to do differently?
Yes.
Immediately, which is great to see for those 18, 19 year olds. And it is a big weekend down at the Frisco College Baseball Classic. Sam Houston on Friday, number 2 LSU Saturday, and then K-State on Sunday. Obviously, you can't look past that Sam Houston one. Oh. But the LSU one, Omaha just beat them this last weekend. That was big time. And K-State, last time Nebraska faced them, Jackson Brockett threw that no-hitter with the Greg Sharp patches on the hats. And guess who's getting the nod on Sunday? Jackson Brockett.
Yep. There were some people asking, is the Jackson Brockett start on Sunday indicative of anything from Will Walsh? And my answer to that would be no. Will had a tough one, not necessarily hitting the strike zone, but handling bunts. And I for a guy that has played enough college baseball to play in different conditions, I don't want to alibi it for him because he wouldn't want me to do that. And I know Will Bolt wouldn't want me to do that either. But the conditions were not ideal. And Louisiana knew it. And I give Matt Deggs a lot of credit for, after Will Walsh had a struggle on the first bunt attempt, which was the situation called for it, Louisiana was trying to be aggressive and give him credit. They did it effectively. Will Walsh coming off the mound, who should have never attempted to throw a guy out at first after he actually fielded the bunt, when he airmails that into right field foul territory, you could tell, I think anybody, it's in your head a little bit. You're on the road. It's a rubber match type of game. So what do they do again? They bunt again and again and again. And they did it on Drew Christo too. It was tough to field the bunt. It was tough, but that was what you should be doing. Just try to generate some offense that way when you got runners on. Unfortunately for Nebraska, they weren't getting runners on, so they couldn't really necessarily put themselves in that position. Right. But Will Walsh is still a strike-throwing machine. He's still a guy that, if he's not the Sunday guy, then I think you have a pretty quality guy on the midweek, which we know that was a big problem last year for Nebraska as well. Probably kept them from being in the hosting conversation because of that midweek record. This is the way I kind of assumed we would eventually get to on a traditional three-game series, is that I still thought Jackson Brockett had a little bit of the edge over Will Walsh. The only reason he didn't start game 3 in this series is because, remember, he had to throw Monday against GCU. So it's a quicker turnaround than what you would normally get with that full week rest. So I thought if he gets the full week rest when they have that first opportunity to do so, it wouldn't shock me to see Jackson Brockett as that game 3 or that Sunday guy. So now the situation for Jackson is you don't relinquish that because Will Walsh is more than capable of being your number 3 or being your Sunday starter as well. And then so whoever isn't, and it'd be great if it doesn't go back to Will Walsh, because that means Jackson has taken this opportunity and he's run with it. He's taken the 3 spot and he's run with it. Because as you know, Caleb, that is an extremely important spot to have, because you might be the guy that they're calling on to win a series, as opposed to, hey, you're the game 3 guy, but we already won the series in game 2. You might be that guy that needs to go out and win that series because it's the rubber match. If Jackson Brockett does not relinquish that, that's a great thing for this team, because, like I said earlier, Jackson is nailed it down, but also you've got a very experienced arm in Will Walsh that can be your Tuesday or your Wednesday guy. And
I think that's the bigger part in this. Mm-hmm. Because think about the last couple of years, how poorly those midweek games have gone for Nebraska. The fact that you're talking about And hopefully, yes, Brockett is lights out on Sunday, and it becomes a really difficult decision for this coaching staff between Brockett and Walsh. But to have whichever one of them doesn't win out to be that Sunday guy as your midweek guy, that's a big deal for this team this year.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that being able to – this is where I also like the fact that these guys have all played enough baseball together where – I heard Jalen Worthley saying this, and the coaching staff talking about Jalen Worthley actually saying this about they know Jalen has starter stuff, but he also saw last year how effective his role in that high leverage reliever where he can give you 40 to 60 pitches, so he can give you a few innings. He also saw how effective and how important that is to this staff. Drew Christo, the same thing. So these are very unselfish guys. And so I think whether it's Jackson Brockett on Sundays and Will Walsh to be your midweek guy or vice versa or somebody else, I think these guys all understand the importance and significance of them all understanding and playing their role in this one too. So to me, that is important for what this team is trying to establish with that rotation, because it is still early on. I think you feel pretty good about what you have on games one, game two. Game three, your Sunday starter in years past has usually been a little bit of guesswork until someone takes over that spot because of performances. But also, I think there are young arms that are candidates for midweek as well. I'm telling you another thing when it comes to guys to keep an eye out for and looking to make that big jump from year one to year two, Carson Yasa, who's got some big time stuff. Big dude. He was touching 96 a couple of times as well. He can get up to 99. If he is doing the Rob Childress mastering the vanilla mindset of strike one, strike two, and your first two pitches, having that 1-2-0-2 count as opposed to that 2-1 or 2-0 count. Mm-hmm. If he can really tap into that, there's another guy that's in a very electric arm. And then two freshmen that I've been so impressed with in their appearances so far. And mind you, it's still early in the season, but they just go in and throw strikes, Price Bender and Colin Novacek. Those guys have, especially Price Bender with the different arm slots going side and submarine. He's creative with the way that he approaches hitters. Those are two guys that wouldn't be shocked as we get into April. They're going to be some big arms out of the pen.
Three games over the next 3 days, Sam Houston, LSU, K-State. If you want to watch those, you got to pay like 30, 40 bucks on D1 baseball, or you can do like I do and pull up the Huskers app and just listen to the Huskers radio network. Nick, it is an understatement to say that it is an ever-changing collegiate athletic landscape. And we'll just focus in on one sport because collegiate athletics as a whole, it's a whole different thing. Right. Like soccer, potentially men's soccer, breaking away into like a 32-team league and running stuff with the United States Soccer League and doing a year-round season. Like, there are so many things you can get into with some of these other sports, but for football specifically, and some of these do involve a number of other sports and kind of NIL across the board, I'm going to give you a few of the things being worked on right now. In New York, there is legislation to make it so that any student athlete who receives aid, which is in return for them playing, which would be, you know, an athletic scholarship.
Right.
They are considered an employee. That's legislation being worked on right now. Louisiana is working on legislation, the same as Georgia, Alabama, and Illinois, for bills to exempt college athlete name, image, likeness compensation from state income tax. Oregon has an NIL bill that has been filed that would prohibit the NCAA or any other organization from requiring college athletes to disclose their NIL agreements if those agreements have non-disclosure or confidentiality provisions. We haven't even gotten to the actual House settlement.
No.
But there are some of these that aren't really covered. They actually go against what that House settlement is. I'm just going to ask you a big question right now. Are we going in the right direction with collegiate athletics?
Personally, for me, I don't think we are. But the problem with what I just said there is, what am I going to do to slow it down? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing is, I feel like once these things get enough momentum, it's the old toothpaste out of the tube where we can't put it back in. It's just how do we maintain the current status quo of what it currently is, or how do we put guardrails so it doesn't get completely out of control? And I think there have been so many factors where, I shouldn't say we, but the NCAA allowed this to take place without really doing anything concrete, to where everything was loosely governed. When it comes to NIL, you know, this better not be any shady business, or else what? Well, we don't really know yet, but we'll do something about it. We just don't know. But beware, because we're watching. No one took that serious, and they won't take that serious. The one thing you brought up that is interesting to me, when it comes to the absolute carousel in college football when it comes to the transfer portal, in the Wild West, if you will, is if all of a sudden your scholarship is considered employment, wouldn't there be some type of contracts involved in that too? Wouldn't there be some type of employment contract involved where you can only leave if X happens or Y happens? I am a fan of that type of language in some shape or form. Now, does it need to be attached to the scholarship itself, or is this something that needs to be more of the revenue share? I don't know. I don't know what the best solution from that standpoint. I've thought, as this thing has completely just spiraled out of control when it comes to you're here one year, gone the next, and you have some student athletes that attend four or five different schools during their collegiate career, that to me is awful. That to me needs to stop. That to me needs some type of deep dive on what you can legally do. And for the, I think you got to involve all parties, what you can do for the sake of the student athlete, but also for the institution itself. What can you do to make sure that when you have that commitment, and now that commitment comes with dollars, not only just scholarship dollars, but dollars on top of that, that you can get that commitment for at least a handful of years. I'm not going to cue the violin for head coaches, especially in the sport of football, given the money that they're making, but it makes their job significantly tougher when the pressure that you have is to recruit the best football team you can year in and year out. And then the pressure that comes with that, the hours that comes with that, the amount of time that you're away from your family that comes with that. And then, oh yeah, by the way, that 105-man roster that you currently have too, you got to re-recruit them too, because they could leave at the drop of a hat, and there is nothing anybody can do about it. Nobody can stop that. To me, there needs to be some type of, if you commit to us, if you're a quote employee, like one legislation once, I would think if you're an employee, that would keep you at least there if you're going to embrace all the things that come with it. The free education, the name, image, likeness opportunity, which you know in football will always be there, and then the revenue share on top of that. If you're going to get all these things, and the student athlete that has more leverage than they've ever had, at the very least, we can give the smallest amount of leverage back to the institution that if you commit to us, we can expect you to be here for at least 2 to 3 years. Unless something catastrophic happens where it's like, yeah, okay, it's probably okay for you to transfer.
Yeah, there's going to be provisions in these. Yes. I mean, we're heading towards contracts. I don't think that's any breaking news. We're heading towards contracts at the very least in football and basketball. And because when you look at the way revenue sharing is going to be utilized, the vast majority of it is going to football and basketball. We have yet to see what it's going to look like split up here at Nebraska. But when it comes to some of these places, Georgia, we just got that actually out just a couple of days ago. $13.5 million for football, $2.7 million for men's basketball, $900,000 for women's basketball is the way it's going to shake out initially. But it's going to be about 80%, 75 to 80% of the money is going to go to football.
Right.
And then basketball is really your other moneymaker for most schools. So what, 10 to 15% there? Mm-hmm. You're down to 5% or less for everything else. So it's going to be football and men's basketball, realistically, is where that revenue share is going to go. And then depending on your school.
Yeah.
Penn State and Iowa, you're probably going to want to throw some money towards wrestling.
Yep.
Nebraska, but it's going to be also interesting with Penn State because they've got a good volleyball program. But places like Nebraska, maybe Wisconsin, you're going to throw some money towards volleyball too.
Yeah. SEC, women's ACC baseball for sure.
Yeah. So you're going to see a lot of that. But when you talk about what head coaches are dealing with now for college football, that's why you're seeing staffs as big as they are.
Yep.
That's why you're seeing them hire, like in Lincoln, you have an associate head coach and just announced last night or reported last night, mm-hmm. you have a general manager. What did you see when North Carolina went through their coaching change? Well, it's a pro style
yeah.
staff. They've got a general manager to handle a lot of the stuff under the head coach. The head coach at this point is essentially the general manager
yep.
and just kind of like delegating everything down. Everyone's got all of their different duties. The staffs are so large. That's where it is right now. And it's, I just want us to skip the part that we're in and get to whatever that end game is, because it's going to be contracts. And when you get to the contracts, it's going, there's going to be collective bargaining. You like, you're going to have to figure out how to do that with thousands of athletes, which is the tough part. That's, I think, what has been holding up a lot of this, but you're going to have to get to that part where you have the contracts and what does that contract come with for the revenue sharing? Because you're only going to have so much money. Is that going to be you? If you come in as a freshman, we'll give you $150,000 of the rev share. You can still have NIL on top of it, but then it'll escalate in year two to $200,000. In year three, we'll go to four. Mm-hmm. And if you're still here in year four, we'll go up to $500,000. Like you really start to split up where some of the things are, and you can't do that for every single athlete, but there's going to have to be provisions. There's going to have to be contracts. I want us to skip the part to where we get to that. As a whole now, with collegiate athletics, because we saw the way the college football playoff played out, and then it became big news here a week ago, and it got brought up again this week because of Matt Rhule being on a national podcast. He talked about why would you ever, if you're in the Big Ten, why would you ever play a Power Four school in the non-conference? This comes up because Nebraska canceled the contract with Tennessee, asked to reschedule. This had been something that had been worked on since mid-2000s, tried to get played in the mid-2010s, got pushed back because Tennessee wanted to play at Bristol. Cool. And then you get to now, and Nebraska is going to have Memorial Stadium renovations. It becomes a financial thing. Let me start with this. I get all of that. I also get that the side effect is you get an easier game. Absolutely understand that. I get looking at what the college football playoff has become in where get through your league and do whatever you have to do in the non-con, but get through your league. Don't even worry about the strength of schedule and you're fine. The thing that I don't get, Nick, is this from Husker fans, where it's, I just win those games. I don't care who the teams are in the non-conference. I took that as being exceptionally soft in the response a week ago. In just go put a bunch of MAC teams and Sun Belt teams and whoever. For us as fans, we don't necessarily have to care about the financial part of it, right? Yeah. Like, obviously, that's going to come up with how good of a team you can put out there, how well the university is doing for a place that runs everything in the black. I thought it was an exceptionally soft response from not every fan, but a lot of people that I saw. But on the side of understanding why Matt Rhule is doing this, why Nebraska is doing this, why this benefits the program, the team specifically for these next couple of years and building things forward. I get all of that from a financial standpoint. As a college football fan, I like to see brands go against brands, and sure, that's one that I was disappointed we're not going to get.
I was too, and not even necessarily for the fact that it would be missing out on an opportunity to see Tennessee and Lincoln. I think it's more of an opportunity of going out to Knoxville and Neyland Stadium and seeing mm-hmm. Nebraska playing on the road in one of the better college football venues. So as traditionalists, you miss out on that opportunity. And this is that word right there, traditional, is something of the past.
It's changing.
It really is. And I remember Trev saying this when it came to all the things that were happening in college athletics with NIL, when Trev said, we got to somehow, some way, get comfortable and being uncomfortable. And I think this is a great example of that, where I said just a couple of days ago, before I heard Matt Rhule say this, that I wasn't overly concerned about the Tennessee series being dropped. And I thought what Troy Dannon brought up from the complications of the stadium and the revenue and the importance now of the revenue more than anything, and even a year where you might take a slight step back with your revenue stream, but you hope to make up for it. I don't think athletic directors can necessarily even afford that, because this is the end game right now, is putting as much money into your athletic department that you possibly can, because you've got to pay the student athletes. You got to be able, if the NIL becomes in-house, you got to be able to manage donations on top of the revenue stream, so you can make sure that you are healthy in every way possible of evaluating, identifying, and getting student athletes over to your school, so you can put out the product that the fans are going to continue to go to the stadium and sell out the stadiums, are going to continue to travel, buy the merchandise, all of the things that you want, mm-hmm. and that you can put on that winning product. It is all about the money, more so than it ever has been, and it's going to impact scheduling. But I still said this, where, okay, I understand they don't want to sacrifice a potential loss in money with reduced seats for that game. And they're going to, you know, they want to have another home game and be able to get that money in. Okay, that makes sense to me. But I don't think this program and other programs will all of a sudden just go a decade of scheduling without at least a Power Four team on their schedule. And then I hear Matt Rhule say that, and I'm thinking, well, maybe I was wrong. I just assumed that, yeah, this is just because of a money thing. But once we get the stadium where we want it to be, we're going to have a Tennessee-type team, or we're going to have a Kansas State, or we're going to have a team that you recognize from a Power Four conference, and we'll have a home and home. You can go there, and they'll come here, and it'll be great. It may not happen as much as it did in the past, but it'll happen once every once in a while. It's the FCS thing. It's not something you're going to see every year. And then you hear the way Matt Rhule talked about it. And the reason I bring that up, I'm not saying I completely disagree with what he's saying. The coaching staffs right now and the athletic directors right now in the Power Four conferences, they are taking their cues from Tony Petitti, from Greg Sankey, mm-hmm. and even the College Football Playoff Committee. And until there's a heavy emphasis on, we're going to ding you for your non-conference, or we're not going to put as much emphasis on the type of conference you're in and the type of schedule that you will have to play for a 9 or 10 game schedule, then let's go ahead and say those 2 non-conference games or 3 non-conference games that you're going to play, do whatever you want, because bottom line, you need to win those games. We don't care if you schedule a Power Four or if you schedule an FCS. That's on you, however you want to decide, but we're not going to ding you for that. And our objectives as a conference is, we're, you know, because remember there was that conversation that took place of maybe forcing your schools not to play FCS opponents. And I know right. There was even some athletic directors saying, okay, we're going to make that decision going forward that we're not going to play any FCS opponents. Well, all of a sudden we've gone completely the opposite on that, where it's like, hey, it might behoove you to play an FCS opponent here or there, or at least a MAC team or a group of five, because we need you and the playoff committee to really emphasize what you're doing in the conference slate of it. And so they're getting their cues from them. And think about it from this standpoint. Matt Rhule, his job is to win football games. Yeah. His job is not to make us as fans happy about the games that we're going to see every year at Memorial Stadium. Until he's told by the conference commissioner and then by his boss, Troy Dannon, yeah, we got to do away with this. We got to schedule a little tougher because it's coming down from the top that this is what we need to do. Then Matt Rhule will do that. Mm-hmm. Just like any other coach, their job is to win football games. And as long as there's no consequences and repercussions that if you beat a Northern Iowa as opposed to a Vanderbilt, why would you? Why would you want to bring Auburn in here? Why would you want to bring Tennessee? If you feel more confident, not only that you're going to get the payday, yeah, you got to pay the FCS teams a little bit too, but that you're going to get that win, it's going to be a lot less challenging than the the power four team or the, yeah, the power four teams that you could possibly be bringing in. I understand it from a competition standpoint. That's his job. His job is to find ways to win football games because you already know what you're up against in the conference. And the SEC teams, they know what they're up against in conference play. Big 12, they know what they're up against in conference play. So I think that this is going to continue to happen. And maybe if you're a fan of FCS football, maybe this gives you another shot of life right now, because at one point I thought FCS football was really going to struggle when it came to getting those paydays and playing power conference teams. Now I feel like there's a resurgence, and I think Matt Rhule is not the only coach that said what he said, or is at least thinking what Matt Rhule said when it comes to why the hell would we schedule them when we need to win football games, and the College Football Playoff Committee saying, you stack wins and take care of business in conference play, you're good, you're in.
I'm curious if that'll change when there's expansion, when it goes from 12 to 16 and you get the Big Ten and the SEC both get four automatic qualifiers and it's based on your conference standing. So at that point, your three games in non-conference don't matter at all.
Yep.
Unless you are trying to get that wild card, unless you're trying to get one of those extra bids. So at that point, it might behoove you to have a Tennessee or an Oklahoma State or a Cincinnati
on your tiebreaker.
Yeah, to try to get to where, no, we have this one up. We finished fifth in the Big Ten Conference, but we've got this one up on that league.
Yep.
So they shouldn't get another bid. We should get that over them. I'm curious if that'll change. You talk about Matt Rhule, and I'm sure there are a lot of other coaches that have been thinking what he's thinking, but he's the one saying it. Now, the other day on when he was talking on the triple option podcast, he's specifically talking to Urban Meyer.
Right.
He says, if we're being completely honest, I'm at a point in my life where in my fourth job and after getting fired in the NFL, I kind of say what I feel nowadays, and I could care less. First of all, he meant I could not care less. But that aside, is there a coach or anyone in collegiate athletics that is more self-aware right now of their situation, their league situation, and college football situation than Matt Rhule? You had Big Ten media days last summer where he said the Big Ten coast to coast should get four in the playoff.
And he got crap for it.
He got crap for it. And what happened? Got four in the playoff.
Yep.
Had the national champion who didn't even play for the Big Ten title. They call off the spring game, and there's going to be a spring event, but call off the spring game. Why? Well, we don't want our players being home shopping networked out on the Big Ten network ahead of the transfer portal. And also you're dealing with roster limitations and where all those things are. He got crap for it. He got dinged from everyone nationally. Well, what does everyone else do? Texas cancels, USC cancels, all these other schools, they follow suit. What happens now a week ago? They call off the Tennessee game. The why? For the athletic director, it's financial.
Yep.
For the college football coach, it's why the hell would we play that game? He gets dinged for it. Not just nationally, but locally. I didn't like it because I like to see brands. But for him as a coach, like you said, his job is not to care about what the brand is that's coming in here. His job is to win friggin' football games. He got dinged for it. But guess what? He's right again. Every step of the way, Matt Rhule has been right. Incredibly self-aware.
I think you bring up a great point. I can't think of a coach who is more self-aware of everything that is going on in college football and given his current situation than Matt Rhule.
And there's, vocal about it too. Not just saying it to his people in the room. He's saying it out loud.
And I don't know about you, Caleb. I appreciate that transparency. And again, this is where I go to the traditional thinker when it comes to not only college football, but especially Nebraska football, where it's so different because you're told to embrace all of the traditions that come with Nebraska football, from the sellout streak to the spring game, to bringing in a marquee opponent every now and then. But you cannot be mad at Matt Rhule for this, and this is the reason why. all of these decisions are dictated because of where college football is right now. Because we can't have it both ways where, hey, you know what? We want the spring game. We want to see those guys competing in everything. Okay, well, then what if two of your key players all of a sudden hit the transfer portal because someone liked what they saw in the spring game, and now you are less effective in having an opportunity to win football games? Wouldn't we, at the end of the day, for every Nebraska fan, whether you're an old school fan or you're new to it, wouldn't, at the end of the day, you much prefer what is going to help this team win now? Then give me that. If you think spring game being canceled and just doing some type of spring event can help us, fine. If you think canceling Tennessee is going to help us and we get more wins and we have a better shot at getting to the college football playoff, fine. Just do what you can that is going to win football games now. And I know it may not seem like it, even coming off of a six win regular season, 7-win after the bowl game. But these decisions are being made because this is what you have to do in college football to maintain roster integrity, to be able to identify talent, to be able to find talent in other places and bring it in, that money, and being able to protect your players from the outside world of getting a good scouting report on them so they can make a run at them. All of these things, which are nothing we're used to seeing, is the current state of college football. I go back to what we said earlier, being comfortable, uncomfortable. Getting comfortable, being uncomfortable. You're going to have to just continue to do that. And I don't like to do this where, hey, fan, this is what you should think. I'm telling you exactly how you should think. But if you're against all this stuff that's happening, A, it's not going away anytime soon. And B, if I were to tell you these decisions are being made because this, in the long run, is going to help Nebraska win. These decisions are going to help Nebraska win compared to the old model. Wouldn't you accept that? I just feel like people need to be open-minded about the end game and the why collectively, because like you said, Caleb, just listen, let Matt Rhule your ear, because he's telling you everything you need to know on why this is happening.
Since he first stepped foot in the Hawks Center and preached at his introductory press conference,
yep,
he's been right. He's been right from day one. And now he's gone through. Obviously, he's updated his coaching staff. A few of those guys actually went and talked their introductory press conferences yesterday. We've got all of those at HuskerMax.com. There will be three more talking next week. We will have all of that coverage at HuskerMax.com. And then we will get into a pre-spring presser in just a couple of weeks with Matt Rhule. So keep an eye out for that coming as well. A couple of other notes. As we know, baseball is in action this weekend. Softball as well. Softball headed off to Wichita State, which is a lot closer to home. They will have a number of games. Number 18, Huskers, taking on South Dakota State. Number 16, Oklahoma State, Missouri, Wichita State, and they'll get Missouri again. Want to mention this, track and field, the Big Ten Indoor Championships. I know a lot of people give some flack about men's teams don't win championships. Well, guess what? Your track team does. And the women's team's pretty darn good, too. You've got several athletes that are sitting number one in the Big Ten on the men's side. Tyus Wilson and Max Otterdahl in the high jump and shot put. On the women's side, Jenna Rogers in the high jump and Axelina Johansson in the shot put. Those are some of the best athletes in the nation. They are in Indianapolis this weekend for the Big Ten Championship, so best of luck to them. I know Rifle, I believe, is into their postseason. There's a lot happening with Husker
Athletics. Bowling is number one, by the way.
Well, yeah, that goes without saying, right?
Yeah.
I know it's been a couple of years, but yes, bowling back on it. Just won the big red invite this last weekend, so a lot of really exciting stuff there. And of course, we will be back on Monday when I'm sure the athletics landscape across college is changed again. I'm sure that's what we'll get.
Most likely. Yes. Yes.
All right, Nick, I know you're off this weekend, but for Husker baseball, we'll all be paying attention to that down in Frisco. And then, like I said, we'll be back Monday, 9 a.m. right here on the Husker Max YouTube page. That's Nick Handley. I'm Caleb Henry for Husker Max Today. Go Big Red.